This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, tensions sometimes boiling over on college campuses across the country. Hundreds of protesters from California to New England arrested. But at one school, a push for understanding and healing.
Viewing each other as family and not as enemies. And through doing that, we can have peace.
Perspectives on both sides of the Israel-Hamas war. Brittany Griner, in her own words, the WNBA star freed from captivity in Russia more than a year ago, recounting her terrifying ordeal.
The mattress had a huge blood stain on it, and they give you these thin two sheets, so you're basically laying on bars.
How Griner is doing today in an ABC exclusive. Could a new type of gadget dethrone the smartphone? Not everyone's convinced.
None of these devices that are coming out have offered anything anywhere close to dethroning the smartphone.
Still, some companies think it can be done. All ahead on Perspective.
Divestment, disclosure, amnesty.
Upheaval on college campuses across the country over the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Schools large and small seeing defiant pro-Palestinian demonstrators take a stand, demanding school administrators cancel any support for Israel and show transparency on financial matters. Some have turned confrontational, with riot police arresting people and shutting down encampments. UCLA saw peaceful protests devolve as counter-protesters showed up in force. But one group at the University of Texas at Austin hopes to change the conversation, bringing pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian sides together to heal. ABC's Byron Pitts goes inside the talks, away from the main protest activity, with students trying to find common ground.
We're called Atidna, so we combine the Hebrew word Atid for future with the Arabic suffix Na for our, and you put those two together, it means our future. We gave our group that name because we truly view ourselves as one family, and we think it's important to allow families to speak.
Jews, Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims, students from across America and around the globe.
I'm a Mexican-American Jew.
I am Iraqi, proud of it, and Muslim as well.
I am Palestinian-American.
I'm originally from Iraq.
I'm an Israeli-American Jew.
My family is Mizrahi, Sephardi, and Ashkenazi.
Elijah Kallenberg founded Atidna International in 2022. He's 21 and Jewish. Jed Hashem is the group's vice president. He's 20 and Palestinian.
Can you be both pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli at the same time?
Of course.
100%.
You can be both.
I believe firmly that you can be pro-human being, first and foremost, because we are human beings, and human rights must extend to everybody on an equal level.
Historically, with human nature, it's hard to have conversation when the blood is warm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right now, the blood is hot.
Very hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so, yeah. And we still think at the end of the day that this is the time to do it. We must take action somehow. We've both had family affected.
Yep.
This is the least that we can do to get something on the grounds here at a grassroots level.
Not for war or occupation!
It's a tall order. Just outside, protests erupting on UT's campus, joining the demonstration sweeping campuses nationwide.
Peaceful protest is all right!
More often than not, shouting begets more shouting. But in here, there's a quiet space to speak their truth and to listen.
This group is a safe space for you.
This is a safe space. I think the existence of this group, mm-hmm. the existence of a group that has Jewish and Palestinian dialogue and Jewish-Arab dialogue, Israeli-Palestinian dialogue, sends a message.
At the end of the day, whether we agree on stuff or not, we all agree that we are all human and that we are all worthy of respect and dignity.
October 7th was a turning point for this group.
I will say, after October 7th, there was a lot of people that said, this is no longer for me. They said we cannot be in the same space.
Is that right? People left your group.
We had people leave.
We had a lot of people leave.
But the group says it began to grow again. The members even organized a vigil a month after the war began.
For UT students to see Israeli students, Palestinian students, professors, to see faith leaders come together, that really resonated with the entire community. I think that what we did is so, so powerful.
When you see these images from what happened on your campus to other campuses, is there a sense of pride, like right on? Is there a sense of anxiety, fear? What's your reaction to it when you see it?
The one feeling I feel is, oh, this is gonna be bad, just selfishly. I don't think that people might take this anger out on Jews. They might, and it might, and they might see this as further proof that there is no middle ground and that there is no nuance. There's a lot of people that don't know what the heck they're talking about. The amount of non-Arabic leftists who are speaking over Palestinians instead of with them, and the amount of non-Jews who are speaking over Jews instead of with them is infuriating. They should be speaking with us and listening to us and uplifting our voices. Yes. They shouldn't be speaking over us. They silence us.
The most American thing that has been done is always a lot of protests have occurred on college campuses, right? Whether it be, you know, anti-war protests, anti-apartheid in South Africa.
Sure.
You know,
civil rights in the 1960s.
Civil rights, especially.
While some of them have participated in protests, their main focus is conversations like these.
I would be doing a disservice if I wasn't having dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, you look at, you know, it's the way to find solutions to this. At the end of the day, if we all want to live in the land, we got to talk somehow. Yeah. We got to talk before it's too late. Find dialogue now before it's too late.
What is more authentic than allowing two people who, I mean, are portrayed as hating each other to be in the same room and say everything that they want to say without anybody telling them that they can't say it.
And all of that, agree on almost.
Really even find a way to have coexistence outside of it. I think we are going chest to chest. Mm-hmm. Nothing is more brave than being able to listen to somebody that disagrees with you fundamentally and also allowing yourself to take that in.
And that's their hope. If they can build civility in a classroom on a campus, could it spread? Some of the founding fathers of America were 20-somethings, they remind me. Brilliant ideas have beaten barbarism and brutality before, so why not now?
What's your hope?
I will give three words. Mutual understanding, nonviolence, and reconciliation. That is my hope for the future.
I will say very similarly, I think the future is unity through a common identity. I think it's viewing each other as family and not as enemies, and through doing that, we can have peace. It's going to happen one day.
ABC's Byron Pitts reporting. Many campus protests have been peaceful, and at some schools, protesters and administrators were able to come to a consensus. At Northwestern University, a deal was brokered, allowing protests until June, transparency in school finance, a pledge to support Palestinian students and faculty, and additional resources for Jewish and Muslim students. Coming up, he was shot for going to the wrong house. Ahead, how teenager Ralph Jarl's family is demanding justice. On Perspective, after this.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
Welcome back to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Demanding change, the family of Ralph Jarl, the black teenager who was shot after going to the wrong house last year in Kansas City, filing a civil lawsuit this week. Jarl's accused shooter, Andrew Lester, and the homeowners association at his property where the shooting took place named as co-defendants. The family says those parties were negligent. Lester will go on trial this fall, but the family says that process is taking too long. ABC's Alex Perez spoke with Jarl's mother, Cleo Nagby. and the family attorney before the suit was filed on their frustrations.
The shooting that gripped the nation as 16-year-old Ralph Jarl shot in the head and arm after he mistakenly knocked on the door at the wrong address.
For those of us who have gotten to see him the last year or so, describe how resilient is he?
He's very resilient, very, very resilient.
It seemed like the world stopped for the Kansas City family last April when then 16-year-old Jarl was sent to pick up his twin brothers at a family friend's home. Jarl got the address mixed up and accidentally knocked at the home of then 84-year-old Andrew Lester, who told police he was startled by the knock and thought he was being robbed when he saw a black male approximately 6 feet tall pulling on the exterior storm door handle. He stated he believed someone was attempting to break into the house and shot twice within a few seconds of opening the door. According to court documents, he opened fire through a closed glass door, striking Jarl, who was unarmed. Jarl miraculously was able to run away. Injured and shocked, he tried getting help from neighbors, some at first turning him away, eventually others helping. The teenager speaking with our Robin Roberts last year.
I was bleeding from my head. I was like, how is this possible? Like, I've been shot in the head.
Had you ever seen that man before?
Never.
Were there any words that were exchanged before he shot you?
He only said 5 words. Don't come here ever again.
Lester was charged with one count of felony assault in the first degree and one count of armed criminal action, also a felony. He has pleaded not guilty and is out on bond awaiting trial later this year.
He's getting to enjoy his sweet old age in the comfort of his home. So we have to put some pressure somewhere.
Jarl family attorney Lee Merritt.
The only remedy available in civil law is fiduciary remedies, is a financial remedy. And so we are looking to essentially take the house from Andrew Lester. He cannot commit this kind of crime against a child and continue to be a homeowner in the region.
Merritt says they are claiming the Neighborhood Homeowners Association was negligent in their civil suit. The civil suit is seeking unspecified damages, Merritt says, and could get delayed until the completion of the criminal case. ABC News has reached out to the Homeowners Association. We have not heard back.
Unfortunately, we can't set the timetable for the criminal trial, and we're dealing with an elderly assailant.
The soft-spoken, good student who plays clarinet and sax in his high school band is now just shy of his 18th birthday, a senior headed to college in the fall. His resilience remains unshaken and only strengthened, his family says, by the thousands of messages of support they've received from around the world. A GoFundMe after the shooting raised more than $3 million.
It was overwhelming, very, very overwhelming. And I cried. I still cry.
That support in the face of the unthinkable, something Jarl and his family say will stay with them forever.
ABC's Alex Perez reporting. At the time of this recording, the Homeowners Association did not respond to the lawsuit. Lester's attorney told ABC News on the day the suit was filed, he couldn't comment because he hadn't seen it. He did not provide an updated response. Breaking the stigma of autism, one active duty Air Force member is teaming up with military brass to raise awareness about the disorder and advocate for more access for those on the spectrum. ABC's John Donvan has the story.
In the last 2 decades or so, the way autism is recognized and defined has shifted immensely. But perhaps not as much has changed for how the military thinks about autism, which is a spectrum diagnosis. There is huge variation among people diagnosed with ASD, but they share one label, and to the Defense Department, it's a problem.
Stephanie Miller is Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Military Personnel Policy at the Department of Defense.
What are the considerations that the military makes in evaluating an individual, their physical health and their mental health?
We want to make sure that as they come in, if they have any pre-existing conditions, that they wouldn't require excessive time away from training or from unit or deployment.
So there's some cost-benefit analysis going
on. There is.
In other words, how much would we have to invest to make this person succeed?
Correct.
And at a certain point, if it's too much, that becomes a disqualifier.
That's correct. While it seems as though you could make those individual accommodations easily, once that starts to compound across a wide number of service members, that can make it difficult to deploy people into a wide different range of environments, often at short notice.
Miller says the military is beginning to take a more individualized approach to autism in the waiver process, reflecting a more nuanced understanding of the diagnosis.
With ASD in particular, what we've seen over the last few years, we've seen about 1,800 applicants come through the process with that diagnosis.
Nationally?
Correct. And we've seen about 500 applicants actually approved for a waiver with a history of ASD.
But Miller admits that this waiver process can be opaque, even lengthy.
We do not necessarily put out a lot of information about the waiver process itself because every review is individualized and depends on those individual circumstances. But we do believe that we need to do more to make the waiver process understood and known.
What's the time? Is it a matter of months? Is it a matter of a day?
It depends on the complexity of the case history. If it's relatively straightforward, then within a few days, you might be able to get a waiver determination. And in more complex cases, it may take a few months.
We want to shift perspectives to an inclusive environment.
Major Daniel Kaiser may be one of the best examples of navigating the service with an autism diagnosis.
For autism spectrum disorder, that could be noise-canceling headsets.
He'd always felt a bit off growing up, struggling socially and with sensitivities to sound and light.
Feel free to like stop, take a break, whatever.
Definitely.
In our interview, he asked if it was okay to wear sunglasses as an accommodation. He was nearly 10 years into serving with the U.S. Air Force when he received an autism diagnosis, having served multiple tours in the Middle East.
How did those deployments go for you?
What I didn't realize at the time, create that overstimulation aspect, make me a little bit more, I guess, snippy with people, more overly blunt. I even got some fairly candid feedback from a commander that people don't really like working with you.
In tandem with that assessment, Major Kaiser began seeing an on-base provider for generalized anxiety disorder when the COVID-19 pandemic pushed care off base.
I was referred off base to a provider who saw me exactly three times before asking me if I'd ever been evaluated for autism spectrum disorder.
What'd you think when you heard that question?
My initial thought was, does this mean I'm going to get kicked out of the Air Force?
Because?
Because I knew it was a disqualifying condition for entry.
Because off-base medical records don't necessarily need to be submitted to the military, Major Kaiser had the option of keeping his new diagnosis a secret.
Did you consider not telling anybody?
No.
How come?
Any consequences of this referral need to be communicated to my on-base provider for continuity of care, and really so the Air Force can make the best decisions about my worldwide deployability status.
He says he got support from his higher-ups and with annual performance reviews, has continued in his role as an instructor in the Air Force Special Operations Command.
Are you good at it?
Yes, sir. I mean, I feel like I'm very good at it. I feel like I have the ability to communicate the magnitude of threats in a way that's easy to understand, and then ultimately how to plan around it.
People's lives are counting on you getting that stuff right.
Yes, sir.
And are there any ways in which you think your being on the autism spectrum actually makes you good at your job?
Definitely.
Like what?
Kinesthetically store and visually recall information, can break that information down to a way where everybody else can understand it.
You think that's because of your autistic brain?
Yes, sir.
A Google search led him to the Air Force's newly formed Barrier Analysis Group. He reached out and started working on their disability action team.
I began to realize, no, we just have a huge population of people like me who potentially...
Who were there all along.
Yeah, who flew under the radar, who weren't diagnosed. I had the benefit of coming in as an officer. Our enlisted force doesn't necessarily have that same amount of protection. So they may join the military, face huge challenges interacting with their peers, keeping up with their peers, and dealing with high stress environments, and then not having the ability to advocate for themselves.
What is your understanding of why the military sees the word autism and says no?
What we are seeing is last century's policy informing decisions that don't mesh well with our modern understanding of autism spectrum disorder. Change the standards
Kaiser is now working with the House Armed Services Committee to help review the standards for autism used by the military for determining eligibility.
We need the best intelligence analysts in the world. We need to have the best linguists in the world. We need to have people within our organization that see things differently so that we can think out of the box and continuously outpace the adversary.
ABC's John Donvan reporting. Coming up, blast off for Boeing, the aircraft maker now going where no plane has gone before. On Perspective, after this.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Libsyn Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to LibsynAds.com now. That's LibsynAds.com.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. I'm Derek Dennis. Coming up, a $1 billion-plus lottery winner steps forward with a big reason why he needs the money. But first, she's been silent for more than a year. WNBA star Brittney Griner, freed from Russian captivity in December of 2022, after being arrested in the country, accused of carrying vape cartridges in her luggage with cannabis oil, which is illegal in Russia. She spent 10 months behind bars and is only now able to talk about her ordeal. She sat down with Robin Roberts in an ABC News exclusive.
WNBA star Brittney Griner detailing her arrest and nearly 10-month detainment in Russia in her new book, Coming Home, telling us exclusively about that fateful day.
You said the whole day felt strange. How?
I was late getting up, never late getting up. Finally got up, literally running around the house. I'm stressing, like I go into straight panic mode.
Brittney says her wife, Sherelle, usually packed for her, but this time she did it herself.
My packing at that moment was just throwing all my stuff in there and zipping it up and saying, okay, I'm ready. In the midst of them going through, you know, my bags, there's two cartridges. And I'm just like, oh my God, how did I make this mistake? How was I this absent-minded, you know, and made this huge mistake? Like I could just visualize everything I worked so hard for just crumbling and going away.
Russian authorities determined that between the two cartridges is actually 0.7 grams of cannabis oil containing THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. The agents take her passport, boarding pass, ask her to sign a form written in Russian that she says she can't read, and she is left to wait. Brittney is transferred to Correctional Colony Number 1, or IK1 as it's known. She is now a prisoner.
What were the conditions like in that particular jail?
The mattress had a huge blood stain on it, and they give you these thin two sheets, so you're basically laying on bars. From middle of my shin to my feet, stuck through the bars, which in prison, you don't really want to stick your leg and arm through bars, you know, because someone go up and grab it, break it, twist it, and that's what was going through my mind.
You were only allowed one roll of toilet paper that had to last you a month.
There was like 2-3 months where we didn't get anything.
134 days into her detainment, Brittney Griner goes on trial in Himki, Russia.
I had no intent to break any Russian laws. I made an honest mistake, and I hope that in your ruling that it doesn't end my life here.
The moment she learned her sentence, 9 years in a Russian labor camp.
And where you're heading to, it's called IK2.
IK2.
Known as one of the worst prisons in Russia.
Yeah.
What were the conditions like there?
Really cold. It's a work camp. You go there to work. There's no rest.
Все хорошо?
Yes. Да, yes.
So I'm picking up these big beams of fleece and cotton and silk. We put it on this machine and you roll it out 100 times. Clamp it, cut it.
The frigid temperatures affecting her health and also her hair.
People knew you for so long with the dreadlocks.
Yeah.
You decided to cut them. What was that like, losing that part of you too?
Honestly, it just had to happen. We had spiders above my bed making nests. My dreads started to freeze. They would just stay wet and cold, and I was getting sick. You gotta do what you gotta do to survive.
Brittany Griner speaking exclusively to ABC's Robin Roberts. Robin's full interview with Griner aired as a special episode of 2020, now streaming on Hulu. NASA is getting ready for a first, launching a spacecraft made by Boeing with humans on board. It's expected to bring astronauts to the International Space Station in what would be Boeing's first ever human space launch. And Boeing has something to prove after years of delays and being one-upped by other companies like SpaceX. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, once an astronaut himself, shares more with ABC's Alex Stone.
Let's talk about Starliner. What does it mean for NASA, frankly, the American population, to have Starliner finally launching? What does this mean?
It means what we intended it to mean, and that is we have two spacecraft that are human rated to be able to go to and from the International Space Station. And by the way, having done this, we are now at the point that we have three spacecraft that are human rated. And the third one, of course, is the Artemis capsule, which is Orion.
So let's talk about that. Some in the public might say, been there, done that. You know, we've seen what SpaceX has been able to do. It's taken Boeing a while to get to where they are now. We've seen a number of delays. Why should Americans care about Starliner going?
Because it is a brand new spacecraft. It is done with a contract on a fixed price basis, and NASA always wants to have redundancy. And so that's why we have this as a second means of getting crew to and from the space station. We also have redundancy on getting cargo to the space station with others other than the SpaceX Dragon.
So speaking of the International Space Station, describe for me what it's going to be like to have competing companies docked at the space station, that you're going to have the Dragon capsule, you're going to have the Starliner capsule. I mean, that's quite a moment.
Well, it's part of the best of America. Let's have companies compete. And so that at the end of the day, we get the best price and the best actual production item, in this case, a very complicated one, a human-rated spacecraft.
The two astronauts going up, I assume that you know them well. They are not newcomers to go into space. Are you going to speak to them beforehand? What do you tell them?
Yes, I've spoken to them many times over the course of the years. And of course, they've been waiting a long time for this. These two are test pilots. Remember, this is a test. This is not your normal Dragon launch. This is the first that humans will ride this particular Starliner spacecraft. And so we put two test pilots in there. If all goes well, and we expect it to, then the next flight will be four astronauts in the Starliner, and they will start part of the regular every 6 months rotation of the crew to the space station.
What is a launch day like, or a return recovery day, but a launch day for you, that you have been in that position now as administrator and in charge of everything? Do you ever feel the butterflies in the stomach? What does it feel like for you now?
Well, when I was in the rocket strapped in, I was along, especially with our crew, cool as a cucumber because you're so focused on what you're doing. But I can tell you this launch for me, it's white knuckle time. There are so many things that could go wrong. We know that it's ready. we're not going to launch it unless we think it's safe. But in spaceflight, there's always a risk, and that's why it's white knuckle time.
Administrator, an honor talking to you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
NASA Administrator Bill Nelson with ABC's Alex Stone. Coming up, dethroning the smartphone. It could be the future of AI technology. On Perspective after this.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You're listening to Perspective from ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. If you're a gamer, beware. One government agency is warning about scammers lurking behind the screen, targeting people who log into video games. And ABC's Elizabeth Schulze says it may be tougher to get your money back if you become a victim.
A new warning for Americans who spend $57 billion every year in the virtual world of video games.
We want to make sure it's not a haven for fraud, scams, and abuse.
Rohit Chopra is the head of the CFPB, the government agency charged with safeguarding Americans' finances. He gave GMA an exclusive first look at a report highlighting how using virtual currencies to buy coveted items like vehicles, weapons, or characters could put real money at risk.
What's pretty obvious is that their financial incentives are for players to spend as much as possible.
I think sometimes it's confusing as to what's real money and what's, you know, fake money.
It's a lesson Michael and Jennifer Ferry's 8-year-old son Joey learned when he unintentionally racked up $4,000 in charges on his parents' credit card.
What was it like looking at that statement and seeing all of those charges?
I lost my mind.
After months of trying, the Ferries finally got a full refund. But the new report warns gaming accounts often lack the security and protections of traditional bank accounts, leaving them open to hacking, account theft, scams, and unauthorized transactions.
When we have a fraudulent charge on our credit card, we can fight it. Many times you see on these gaming platforms, there's really just finger pointing or not really taking accountability.
The Entertainment Software Association, which represents the video game industry, tells us we are committed to providing players and parents with transparent information and tools to make appropriate choices for themselves and their families, including the ability to manage in-game purchases, limit or block communications with other players, and manage when and for how long their children can play.
What would you say to critics who say it's not really the CFPB's role to be looking at the video game industry?
I think we shouldn't think of this as traditional video games. Mm. It's an immersive world where there is its own economy. But what we want to make sure is that it's not just a way to sidestep existing rules.
ABC's Elizabeth Schulze reporting. If 2023 was the year of AI software, 2024 is shaping up to be the year of AI hardware. Over the last few months, everything from smartphones and laptops, even glasses, have been shown off at slick presentations and glitzy launch events. And now a new type of gadget is on the horizon. ABC News technology reporter Mike Dubusky takes a look.
At the TWA Hotel in New York City last month, customers took delivery of the very first Rabbit R1s. The R1 is bright orange. It's about the size and shape of a packet of sticky notes. It's got a tiny 2.9-inch screen, a camera in the top right corner, and a button on the side to activate voice controls. The idea, according to Rabbit CEO Jesse Liu, is to reduce the amount of steps it takes to do something on a smartphone.
Our mission is to create the simplest computer.
Instead of sifting through pages of apps and notifications, trying not to get distracted by Instagram, Rabbit says you can just speak a command to the R1, and using an artificial intelligence technology they call a large action model, it will do it for you. At least that's the idea.
You find that you're addicted to your phone?
Oh yeah, super addicted.
Daniel Ko is a fractional CFO for AI startups. He says his work doesn't involve Rabbit at the moment. He's just a customer for now, but he sees a lot of potential in the $199 R1.
In a way, it's like the first generation product of something that could be, you know, like the next iPhone, maybe.
I think in this moment, I'm just curious.
Danny Cole is an artist based in New York. He says he likes the idea of a device that moves us away from smartphones.
I think it's tough for us to predict if phones are the answer to our needs in 10 years from now, in 20 years from now. They're probably not.
Jonah Cohn is a college student in Chicago. He came to New York just so he could pick up his R1 in person.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely consider myself like a serial early adopter.
But he says that early adoption is risky, especially when it involves artificial intelligence, which has faced criticism for being unreliable and inaccurate.
Yeah, I was scared that I was going to get this thing and it's not going to do what it says. And I still haven't figured that out yet because, you know, even though I just got it, I've only had it for like 5 minutes.
Rabbit isn't the only tech company staking a claim in the AI gadget world. Humane, a company founded by several former Apple employees, recently started shipping the AI Pin, a $700 wearable device.
The AI Pin is a totally new kind of computer.
Bethany Bongiorno is the CEO of Humane. She says despite the price tag and the $24 a month phone plan, the Pin is not meant to be a smartphone replacement.
When you got a smartphone, it didn't replace your laptop, but it created a very different relationship with your laptop. It was much more focused.
According to Humane, a phone is for things like watching videos or scrolling social media. The Pin, meanwhile, is intended to handle tasks like sending messages, setting reminders, and looking things up. The Pin's answers, like the Rabbit, are generated by a combination of large language models, artificial intelligence technology, from companies like OpenAI and Google. Bongiorno says it's all in an effort to keep users from getting sucked into their phones.
I prefer my Pin in more moments throughout the day because I choose to want to remain present.
But reviews of the AI Pin have been overwhelmingly negative.
The Pin is not worth the money.
The new worst product I think I've ever
using
reviewed.
The Humane AI Pin just makes me feel dumb. I look stupid wherever I go.
So there was this big backlash back when the Humane AI Pin reviews came out where a lot of the reviews were negative, including mine.
Julian Chikatu is the reviews editor at Wired. He says his complaints with the Pin covered everything from its limited features, its unreliable AI-generated answers, even overheating issues that made it uncomfortable to wear. Humane, for its part, says these problems will be addressed in software updates down the road. In that case, Chikatu says buyers should hold off. After all, he says most people already have a device that does everything the AI devices try to do.
I personally think none of these devices that are coming out have offered anything anywhere close to dethroning like the smartphone.
About a week after the Rabbit event, Danny Cole tested his R1 in a park in Brooklyn.
This is a Jeep Wrangler.
Oh.
After 1 week of ownership, Cole says he's disappointed with his purchase. He says it's missing features he was expecting to be there, and the R1's reliance on AI for its responses means it can be inaccurate. Rabbit tells ABC News the accuracy and detail of the R1's responses is based solely on the large language models it uses. Rabbit also started sending out software updates to address some issues, but for now, Cole's smartphone isn't going anywhere.
It's not useful until you can rely on it to work.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Before we go, the story of a lucky lottery winner who not only could use the money, but really needs it. 46-year-old Chang Charlie Safin, an immigrant from Laos in Southeast Asia, coming to the U.S. in 1994, and has now come forward to claim last month's historic $1.3 billion Powerball jackpot. He and his wife and a family friend bought 20 Powerball tickets for the big jackpot in hopes of winning. And they did.
We're rich.
But if that's not reason enough to celebrate, Charlie has been in cancer treatment for the last 8 years and has been worried about medical bills piling up. Now he has plenty of money and a plan.
I can rest my family and find a good doctor for myself.
Last month's staggering billion-dollar-plus Powerball jackpot was the fourth largest in history. Charlie says he'll share the jackpot with his wife and their family friend, 50-50, and he can now take his pick of good doctors in his cancer fight so he can win the real jackpot of a long, healthy life. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. This show is produced by Aaron Ferrer, Marwa Muwaki, and Joy Piazza. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review. If you've got the time, tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.